This podcast episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/SFBRP. Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. And it's a good job that I don't have a set schedule, because I would have totally broken it, whatever happened, whatever it could have been, weekly, monthly, whatever, it would have been totally broken, because there's been a massive gap since my last podcast and this one, probably about 5 weeks or something like that between the two podcasts, which is probably the largest gap between two podcasts that I've ever had before. And there's many reasons for this. One is that I was reading a very big book, a very chunky book, and it took me a long time to get through the audiobook version. Another is that when I got back in Berlin again, I've been very busy while I've been at home and not done much reading there, mainly because my girlfriend Juliana is moving in with me, or she has moved in with me, and that's been quite a big process. When I first moved into this apartment, there was two people, me and Pola, previous girlfriend. Long-time listeners will remember me mentioning Pola, and there was two of us living here, and then it was just me living here for a few years, for 3 years, and then now it's suddenly two people living again in the same apartment, and that's a weird kind of process to go through, making a one-person apartment back into a two-person apartment. So a lot of work gone in there. And also, when I got back to Berlin, I've been really ill. You could probably tell from my voice that my nose is still blocked up. I've been ill for the last, 12-13 days in a row or something like that, so it's not been good. And the other thing, the other reason why I've not done a review for a long time is because I've been working on other projects, and people who follow me on Goodreads can see some of the other books that I've been reading, non-fiction, non-science fiction or fantasy books, and this is for quite an interesting project that I'm working on now. Long-term listeners will know that I have a big interest in science fiction, and also a big interest in the Bible and biblical criticism and things like that. I sometimes bring it up on the show, and so I've decided to actually put together my different interests into a book project, and that'll be probably just an ebook, but about the similarities between the textual history of the New Testament and the issues that come up, and why I'm fascinated with the history of the Bible as an interesting piece of literature, you know, the writing of it and the development of it and the selection of it and the editing of it and all that different kind of stuff, comparing that to a very well-known science fiction franchise, which is, of course, the Star Wars movies, and the way that the Star Wars movies have developed. It starts off with just one movie, and then it extended in one direction, and then extended back in the other direction, and all the different edits and different things that go on there is very similar. I found it's very lots of places where the ideas and themes, and not so much the themes of the material, but the way that the text has changed in the Bible over time, and the way that the material within the movies themselves have changed over time with the different edits, the official edits that, you know, George Lucas has done, and the extra movies that he made, along with fan edits. Now, the idea is this book, the name idea that I have, it's going to be called Matthew, Mark, Luke, Skywalker. So that'll probably be finished. Well, I don't know when it'll be finished. It's going to be a long time. But one of the projects that I've done beside that is to do my very own fan edit. So I completely re-edited Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, from scratch. And that was about 80 hours of work to do a complete new re-edit of that movie, to transform it into a totally different movie with a totally different story, or lots of different story elements and science fictional elements in there as well. So I will be releasing details of that and how to get hold of that in a copyright non-infringing way, so I don't get into trouble and you don't get into trouble. If you want to check that out in the future, email me about that if you're interested in checking that out. So that's what I've been working on, and that's why this review is taking a long time. Also, you might have noticed at the beginning of the podcast that I mentioned a bit about Audible sponsorship or Audible affiliation there with the podcast. I'll talk to you a bit about that more later on in the podcast, but if you want any more details, just check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And with that, I think I'm through the different notes that I have here at the beginning of the book. So let's get on to today's, this episode's review, which is Stephen King, The Stand. This is the first Stephen King novel that I've read and reviewed for this podcast. I've actually read other bits of other stories of his, mostly short stories. I can't remember. I think I read The Stand once, and I've listened to some different audio versions of his stories, and also, of course, I've seen a lot of movies that have been made from his stories and his novels and his short stories. Some of my favourite films, of course, lots of everybody's favourite films were based on his writing. So I thought, well, let's just check out one of his classic works. And I wanted to pick something which was more kind of science fictional, fantasy, rather than just a horror one. And some people said, hey, how about The Stand? Because there's like this recent expanded edition, the full uncut edition came out. The Stand was originally published in 1978, and then it was updated. I think it was first a short story, and then it was updated to a novel, but then it was too long. So this was mentioned in the preface or the introduction to the Stand, and Stephen King said that there was lots of material that he had to cut out just for length reasons, just because it was going to be taking up too much paper. And so in 1990, he put back in all the original material and changed around and rewrote different sections. And so the version that I had was the audible version, narrated by, let me just bring this up here, Grover Gardner. And it's 47 hours and 52 minutes long, which I think that makes that the longest audiobook that I've listened to, up there with, what was it called, The Name of the Wind or something like that. I know those were very long books. So people, of course, on goodreads.com have been joking about this, that I went from The Way of Kings, which was a massive chunky book, to The Stand, which is another massive chunky book. And what's the next book that I'm going to read? Is it going to be, you know, Infinite Jest or some other massive long book? But no, it's not. So anyway, I just thought this would be interesting because I read a bit about this book, and it said, let me actually just bring it up here. It says, so it's meant to be sort of like Stephen King's kind of retelling. It's like he said he wanted to make a Lord of the Rings for modern America. And it's post-apocalyptic fantasy set in the 20th century. And I was like, well, this really appeals to me. So I thought I'd give it a go. I knew what I was getting into with a massive long audiobook, but it was a good way to fill up lots of flights and different journeys. Oh, that was another reason why it took me so long to get through this. I broke my headphones when I was going along, so I couldn't listen to any audiobook easily while I was moving around. And then I bought myself a new set of headphones when I was in New York. And then as I got on the plane to go back across, so I had like, what, 8, 9 hours or something of travel time ahead of me, then I broke the headphones again. So I managed to break two sets of headphones within a week, and the second set less than 24 hours after buying the set of headphones, I managed to break it again, which is the kind of thing I do. One day I'll post a picture of all of the different headphones that I've broken, because every time I break a set of headphones, and I use headphones a lot, especially, well, you know how much I listen to podcasts and listen to audiobooks, so I've got a massive collection of broken headphones. I'll take some photos of that one day, count up how many I've got here. Anyway, what was I doing? Oh yeah, so I started listening, and that really got into it. It's really interesting. So it's set in 1990. Originally, the book was set in 1978, or early 80s, or something like that. But then it was updated with different cultural references from 1990. You know, there's references to Ronald Reagan and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and things like that. But the world is pretty much as we know it now, or as we knew it in 1990. Same level of technology, same politics, pretty much everything is the same, except, of course, later we do get the fantasy elements. But pretty much all of the action takes place in America, in different cities, and the roads in between different cities and small towns across the United States. And that is, of course, a very specific choice by Stephen King. He even hints at some points that different parts of the world have got the similar stories going on in different parts of the world, but this is America's post-apocalyptic story. So what happens is, right at the very beginning, we get introduced to a few different characters, but pretty soon we get the story of Stu. No, let me go back a bit. So we get this guy, there's this a security guard who works at a military research laboratory for bioweapons. So what happens is that they've developed this super flu, this super influenza kind of thing, and accidentally it gets out, and there's a mistake on a circuit board, which means that the alarm doesn't go off, and everything doesn't get shut down. And this security guard managed to escape, and he goes, "Okay, we've got to get out of here. We've got to get out of here." And he gets his son. And is his son, his baby, and his wife, and they head off into the night in the car. And you think, well, what's going to happen here? But of course, you know what's going to happen here. We've got to get this disease out and spread it around for an apocalypse to happen. And it runs into a petrol station. The car crashes as the people inside die. And a guy called Stu Redman is there when the car crashes, and he's one of the first people to get the disease, except he doesn't get the disease. Everyone around him gets the disease, and then the disease starts spreading and spreading and spreading, and I think it's like a 99.3% mortality rate from anyone who contracts it, and it starts spreading around America, and also not just America. It keeps spreading and spreading and spreading. So the first kind of like, I'd say probably the first like fifth of the book, maybe the first quarter of the book, really tells the story of how this disease spreads, and we get introduced to lots of different characters. Some of the characters make it through, some of the characters die, and you're never quite sure, but you realise that, of course, the ones who get a bit more backstory are probably going to live a bit longer. But in this book, it really is like you never know which character's going to make it through to the end, or if a character's going to make it even to the next page or even a few pages on, which is actually quite refreshing in a book like this. So, yeah, we get a lot of stuff about the disease spreading. And I'd say this is probably where most of the kind of horror elements come into it, where people have to sort of like, you know, look after each other, and this person's vomiting. And it's, I think this is where Stephen King's writing really, really holds, really comes into its own when he's talking about different characters and who they're going. So let me just give a quick rundown on some of the characters here. Did I make a list here? Oh no, I said look at the wiki. There's a Wikipedia page called List of Characters in the Stand, or List of the Stand Characters, which just shows how many there are. Yeah, so you've got like Stuart Redman. I talked about him. He's like this, he's always called Hey East Texas, because I guess he comes from East Texas. You get a guy called Glenn Bateman, who's this university professor. We don't really get him very much at the beginning of the book, but we've learned about him later. Larry Underwood is one of the main characters. He's a musician. I can't remember where he's originally from, but then he goes out to LA and he gets a record deal, and we hear quite a bit about that, and you know the song that he gets, and he kind of gets into trouble with some drug dealers there, and then goes back to New York, and then his story pretty much starts in New York, and when his mother contracts the flu, and he goes out and tries to find his way around New York and try and get out of there. And then the other main character at the beginning of the book is Frances Goldsmith, and she is, we find out right at the very beginning that she's pregnant. And she gets in contact with the guy who is the father, and she talks about it with her father and her mother, and there's a whole relationship there as well like that. And most of everybody that all of these characters know, Stuart and Francis and who are these? Yeah, Larry Underwood and all these other guys. Oh, and there's also two other characters that I really enjoyed was Nick Andros, who is a deaf mute, who is kind of taught himself how to read and write, and he communicates by writing things in bits and paper and passing them around. So he's a very interesting character as well, because he survives, but everyone thinks he's an idiot because he's deaf and mute. But you know, some people work out that he's not an idiot, and he becomes very important later on in the book. Another one is called Tom Cullen, and Tom Cullen is an idiot. He can see, he can speak and hear, but he's a really interesting idiot character. I don't even know what to say. Yeah, he's like the mystical idiot, and he's always talking about this. Oh, Tom Cullen doesn't like this. Tom, M-O-O-N, that spells Tom Cullen. You know, that's his little catchphrase, spelling M-O-O-N, that spells water or whatever, you know, and because he can't spell, he can't read or can't write or anything like that. But again, he's these interesting characters. Now, what happens is, of course, everybody that all of these characters knows dies except them. And so they suddenly have to go, well, what am I going to do in the world? What am I going to do? There's nobody else around. There's a few people in New York, and there's a few people in this town, and a few people in this city. In fact, Frances Goldsmith, the girl who's pregnant at the beginning, she knows someone called Harold Lauder, who lives in the same town and is friends with his sister. Harold's sister is friends with Frances, and so he becomes a main character as well, because they actually know each other already. And I think that's the only example where two characters who know each other before the apocalypse hits, before the flu hits, who actually know each other. So what happens is that we have these different characters, and you're like, okay, so after an apocalypse, what's going to happen? And what happens is that the kind of fantasy, kind of mystical elements start coming in. They each start having dreams individually, and the dreams say what you should do is make your way to this small town in Nebraska, and there you'll find someone called Mother Abigail. who is one of the oldest women in the United States of America. I think she's like 107 years old or 103 years old or something like that. And she becomes this mystical figure that everybody is drawn to. And that's where I'm going to leave it for now. Of course, I'll get a bit more into the story, but that really sets up the story that after all of this this flu spreads around and wipes everyone out, a bit like Earth Abides. In fact, the Wikipedia page here says, let me look it up here, yeah, the author also mentions George R. Stewart's novel Earth Abides, which describes the odyssey of one of the last human survivors after the population is decimated by a plague. And he calls that one of the main inspirations for The Stand. And of course, you can see that it's right there. You know, it's very obvious that that is one of the main influences. And so, yeah, so we get this thing where everyone has to come together under under the influence of dreams that are kind of weirdly emanating from Mother Abigail. However, at the same time, there's another group of characters. There's a guy called Lloyd, and who is a petty criminal who goes on a shooting gun spree after a botched robbery, under the influence of another character called the Kid. So you got Lloyd, and then you got the Trash Can Man, and the Trash Can Man is a guy who is always setting fire to things, he's a total pyromaniac, and he sets fire to this, and he accidentally kills this person, sets fire to this, sets fire to this, and these two people survive, and these two people really represent the these people represent the other side of society, whereas Stuart Redmond and Larry Underwood are sort of like just everyday folks who want to get on with stuff. Lloyd and the Trash Can Man and some of these other characters that we read about, they're kind of like the dark side. I know it's weird to say the dark side, but it really is sort of like a good versus evil kind of situation in this book. And it's not just me saying, oh, it's good versus evil. No, it really is. I mean, that's what they actually say in the text. Stephen King actually writes this. This is a story about good versus evil. And they have their own person who is calling out to them in dreams. And he's called the Dark Man or the Walking Dude, otherwise known as Randall Flagg, RF. I'm not sure what the initials RF stands for, because he goes under different RF initial names, but he's pretty much Randall Flagg is the name that is settled on by the different characters in this. And he is setting up like his own kind of society, opposite Mother Abigail's on the other side of the Rockies, I guess, or is it the same? Yeah, it's kind of the other side of the Rockies, in Las Vegas. And he is bringing together the more criminal elements who survive into a united civilization, into a united force there. And so the rest of the book really plays out these two groups of characters, one good group and one bad group, going together. And in the good group, some of the characters turn out not to be so good, and in the bad group, some of the characters turn out to be, of course, not so bad and are wondering which way to go. But the bad group is like, you know, Randall Flagg really does rule Las Vegas with an iron fist. And they're, you know, all these people are drawn together by the dreams. And this is a, like you say, when you actually look at this as a companion piece to The Lord of the Rings, it really does work out. You see a lot of the Fellowship of the Rings, lots of people coming together and lots of incidents on the way where people are going first to Nebraska and then they all go to Boulder in Colorado, which I think was picked because Stephen King lived there when he wrote this novel. But anyway, yeah, they go to Boulder and other people going like that. And then over in Mordor, which is Las Vegas, Randall Flagg, which is, I guess, Sauron, and he's sort of bringing together the forces of bad. And over on the other side, the forces of good are going on there as well. So that's the story. I know it's quite complex, but, well, it's not too complex, but it's there. And it takes a long time to go through, in exactly the same way that The Lord of the Rings takes a long way to go through. And there is lots of walking. A lot of the book is taken up with people walking between different towns, or driving between different towns, or riding bikes between different towns, and the different adventures that they go along the way, and the different people that they meet up with. Again, it's very much of a setting off from this place and getting to this place kind of story. And the things that happen along the way. In Boulder and in Las Vegas, we do get some pretty interesting sort of like setting up a civilization after the apocalypse kind of stories, which is, again, quite interesting. Lots of trying to get the power back on, trying to get the lights back on, burying different bodies, setting up committees, setting up different political systems, and the way that these are kind of reflected on different sides of the story in Las Vegas and across in Boulder, that sort of like plays off each other. And then, of course, at the end, you do get... I actually really like the end. because it comes down to, again, a battle between good and evil. But on one side, actually, I'll talk about a bit more about that later on. Let me first get into the what have I got notes here? Oh yeah, the characters. I kind of mentioned them already. Yeah, again, some of my favourite characters, it was Larry Underwood, because he really seemed to go on the biggest journey, kind of the biggest journey. He starts off and he's trying to selfish and he's trying not to be selfish and he keeps going and going. And of course, you can kind of see that he's going to get better. And later on, he does become one of the leaders in one of these new communities. And when he starts off as like a drug addled musician in Las Vegas, you're really not quite sure which side he's going to go to. So that's an interesting story. And Stu as well. I always thought Stu seemed to be the main character in the book, because he was there right at the beginning and goes throughout most of the novel. Again, I don't want to give away what happens too much, but most of the novel does seem to revolve around him, and he does become one of the main leaders in the Nebraska / Boulder, Colorado community. But I never really grabbed onto any aspect of his character, which really stood out. He seemed to be quite like an everyday guy, which is good. But I thought with Larry there was more great. Larry and Francis and Nick Andros and Tom Cullen, these other characters, they seemed to have something that really stood out. Whereas Stu seemed to be quite a basic character. Frances, again, I really enjoyed her because, you know, she's always got the, oh, I'm pregnant kind of thing going on, which might sound, you know, it could have been like really, oh, like that. But when the end of the world is happening, that you have a baby is actually, of course, quite important. And you're always thinking, okay, is this baby going to get through? Is this baby going to survive? And that's one of the main sources of tension, drama throughout the novel. And of course, you got these two really interesting characters that I really enjoyed, Nadine Cross and Harold. Harold, I can't remember his second name. Anyway, Harold and Nadine, they kind of are two people who kind of are a pair, in that they're part of the group who are on the good side, but also have tendencies to go across to the bad side for totally different reasons. And that's what I really enjoyed is, okay, why would you go to the dark side rather than to the light side? And there's a good exploration of all that kind of thing going on. And on the other side, the Trash Can Man I thought was really, really good fun character. Lloyd as well. He starts off as a bit of an idiot, but then you realise later on, I was like, wait a second, is this the same guy who was this idiot early on? And now he's kind of like running things on this other side. And I think that's actually a really interesting character transition that he goes through, that when you give someone more intelligence to be able to run things, you also kind of let the, like, open Pandora's box so they know the difference between good and evil. And in this case, he knows that, in some cases it could just be, oh, everything was always really perfect, and now they know the difference between good and evil, and they get that intelligence, and suddenly, oh, now things are going bad. Whereas in the case of Lloyd, it's like, well, he's a total idiot, and he does everything wrong, and then he kind of gets that gift of the knowledge of good and evil, the knowledge of, like, a sort of intelligence and human intelligence, fire is brought into his life, and suddenly he can start telling the difference and going, wait a second, we need to make things better. So there's a really interesting character transition as well, and there's a lot of interaction. Like, there's scenes between every two of these characters. You know, there's a scene between Tom and this person, a scene between Nick and this person, and then Nick and that person, Nick and that person. Oh, the thing that annoyed me a little bit about Nick was that he's deaf and dumb, and he has to write everything. And it was just one of those things that maybe if you read it in as a paper book, which I didn't do, but maybe if you read it and you actually read some of the conversations that he had with people and the notes that he would have to write and then give to someone for them to read, for them to understand his language, it seemed a little bit like, okay, he wouldn't have actually written it in long hands like that. It makes sense, of course, for a conversation as written in a book, but I think his notes would have been a lot shorter, like not all written out in long hand full paragraphs and sort of like, well, let me tell you what I think. I think blah blah blah. Well, if you're writing it out, you probably wouldn't say, let me tell you what I think. You'd just write what you think and pass it to them, and you passing it to them would tell them what you think. And also, he seemed to be, I don't know how easy it is for people who are deaf and dumb to lip read, but he seemed to be expert lip reader kind of guy. Oh, can you hear that? That's my phone going off there. So that's an interesting thing as well. Oh, yeah, and of course, what am I going to see here? I'm looking through my notes. Oh, yeah, so science fiction and fantasy elements in this book is, I think, is a really good mix. I really enjoy reading apocalyptic fiction and post-apocalyptic fiction where people have to rebuild society, and a big part of this book is that, two different stories of two different societies rebuilding after society, and some of them are more interested in weapons and some of them are more interested in getting the power back on and different things. Now, what I really enjoyed about this was that even in the book they said, well, back over there in Las Vegas, Randall Flagg is gathering together all of the technicians and people like that, all the technicians and scientists who have a disregard for humanity to the point where they were the kind of people who made this super bug weapon which wiped out all of humanity. And so the people who don't care about repeating the mistakes of the past, they're all getting together over there. And I thought that was a bit weird, but okay, I was like, okay, I'll go with it. Some people, like you say, it's not like, even though it's a good versus evil, it's not a black and white kind of thing. Some people on one side are more technical and some people on the other side are less technical, whatever. But there is a good mix there as well. And I do always enjoy reading descriptions of what the Earth will be like when you take away all the humans, and sort of how the world degenerates after humans are taken away, or on the other side, how nature regenerates once the destructive force of humans taken away, and that's a bit. And on the magic side and the fantasy side, of course, I just mentioned before about the different dreams, but you do get a lot more things like that. Again, kind of Eye of Mordor stuff with remote viewing and being able to follow people and secret knowledge. There is a few other larger fantasy things that come in later on, but it really builds up to that. And I'll get onto that in a minute when I talk about the themes of the book at the end. Which brings me on to the writing. I really enjoy this book. Stephen King is, of course, a really great writer. He writes amazing scenes. I'm not saying that the overall story of the book is worth it for the amount of book. I think the overall story could have been told a lot quicker. However, each individual scene I really, really enjoyed. There's some really surprising twists within the scenes. And I know that I read his Stephen King On Writing book. I read that as an audiobook. I listened to that as an audiobook before and really enjoyed it. And he talks a lot about how he sets about writing scenes and writing books. He's very much, he doesn't plan ahead all the way through to the end of the book. He comes up with ideas. He comes up with scenarios and puts interesting characters into those scenarios and see how they play out. And there's a lot of really interesting seeing how things play out. A lot of very poetic language in some cases. Again, I can't come up with any examples off the top of my head, but there's a really interesting use of language as well. So I would definitely read other Stephen King books, even if the story isn't great. Like, even if you don't like the ending, you get 90% of the way through the book. That first 90% of the book is full of some amazing writing, really interesting characters, and really interesting different scenarios and different little situations and little story arcs that go through over the course of a few chapters, which I really enjoy. Let me talk a bit about the audio. The Grover Gardner is a really great audiobook narrator. He narrates loads and loads and loads of books. I know I've read a few or listened to some books that he's done before. He was also a guest on the SFF Audio podcast as well. That was an interesting discussion that he had with Jesse and Scott over there too. So I know him from there. A really great narrator, and it's good because he's got a lot of characters to get through and lots of stuff to read. So if you're gonna go for an audio book and you want your money's worth, you can, like, 48 hours of listening. And I don't think, if it was a less proficient, or if it wasn't Grover Gardner or someone like that who I know I can listen to, I probably wouldn't have got this book. I wouldn't have bet on a narrator that I wasn't quite sure of, because there have been a few audiobooks where I've really struggled with the narrator. Just go back a few episodes and check out, what was it called? The 100,000 Kingdoms for my problems with a bad audiobook narrator. But Grover Gardner is an excellent reader, which actually brings me on to something I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, and that was on the little pre-roll thing there, which is, of course, the Audible.com affiliation kind of thing that I'm doing at the moment. So let me just explain the way this works. So I've been a member of Audible.com. I've got a platinum plan and have been for, what, 2.5 years now. And everyone who's listened to this podcast knows that I'm a really big fan of Audible and that I use it all the time. Probably around about half the books that I've listened to, or half the books that I've reviewed here on this podcast since then have been that I have got them through audible.com. And so some people at audible.com sent me an email saying, hey, how would you like to become an affiliate podcast with Audible? And I was like, okay, what are the deals? And it turns out it works like this. So if you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, audibletrial.com/SFBRP, you can, if you go there, you can sign up to for a free 30-day trial. And in that free 30-day trial, you get a free audiobook, any audiobook that you want. Now, if you want to, you get one credit, it's called. And if you continue on after that, there's different plans that you can sign up for. The gold plan means you get one audiobook a month, which is probably best, which is good for most people. I am a platinum member, which means every month I get 2 credits. At the moment, I've got a few credits left over, but it's a really great way to do it, and you get massive savings on this. Like being a gold member, it works out maybe $10 a month. I'm not entirely sure because I pay in euros, but it's really great. But if you buy individual audiobooks, like here it says The Stand, a regular price would be $38 for this book, or a member price would be $27, or one credit, which works out at around about $10-$12 or something like that. So that's the kind of thing that you get. Of course, you don't have to continue the trial. If you just want to have the audiobook for free, go across to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and you can get that free book, and it's yours for as long as you want. You can listen to it on your iPhone or on your iPod or on your Android phone and loads of other different devices, or just listen to it on your computer. I do that sometimes as well. So check it out. And of course, if you don't want The Stand, you can have any book. It says here there's 100,000 titles, more than 100,000 titles here. One of the best things to do is actually go to sfbrp.com and check out the episode list. And if you go to the sort by, let me find this list here. It says sort by star ratings, and you can see some of the highest rated books, and quite a lot of these are actually audiobooks that I got from audible.com. So here we go. 5 stars, one of the only 3 books that I gave 5 stars to is Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, that I got that from Audible. I Am Legend, 1984. I think Anathem is on there as well. These are some of the top rated books that I've, Fire Upon the Deep by Verna Vinge. They've got that, loads of other great books there as well. So go and check it out. And in return, Audible gets a new listener, and I actually get some monetary support, which is really handy for paying for bandwidth and all the other stuff, my other costs here that I have doing this podcast, which isn't a lot, but it'll be great. It was just a trial membership for you, and also a trial for me to check out the audible.com sponsorship here as well. So I thought I'd just throw that in here. Let's get back to the review then. So I want to talk a bit about the themes in this book, because I think there's some really interesting stuff going on here. First of all, whenever you're reading apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic stories, you always have to think, okay, what is the story really about? And it's a bit tricky. Like, if you read a book like Flood, by Stephen Baxter, which I reviewed here. I'm going to stick to books that I've read and reviewed for this in this podcast, so you can get more details and my thoughts on these ones. But with Flood, it's really just one guy is going, hey, wait a second, the sea level is rising. And then the entire book is talking about what happens over the course of this very, very long, extended, apocalyptic, end of the world kind of scenario. And so the characters really fade into the background, and everything else really fades into the background. It's really lots of details about how high the water level is getting. And you're thinking, well, nothing that the characters really do, nothing they do is really going to matter at all. Because in the end, well, they can build a boat, but and things just play out despite them almost. I mean, there is other things going on there in the book, but it's really difficult. Like, a lot of the stories go on and you think, well, this story could almost have been told without the flood, and other stories which are, you know, not interesting. And then there's Lucifer's Hammer, which is like, okay, the first third of the book is about, you know, someone predicting that the asteroid is going to hit the Earth. The middle third of the book is the asteroid hitting Earth, and you get those really detailed descriptions of what's going on and how the Earth is coming to an end. And then the last half of the book, you're like, well, what is the last half of the book about? And really, it's about people trying to rebuild the society. But unlike Earth Abides, which the entire story is about what happens afterwards, yeah, they got to go, okay, the main drama, which is who is going to die when the asteroid hits, is over. And now we've just got to do the aftermath. So the aftermath becomes, oh, we're going to, oh, well, what's going to happen? Well, let's have some good people trying to rebuild society, and then other parts of humanity devolves into rabble. In that book, lots of black people fighting white people, and the black people are all idiots and bad and cannibals and things like that, and the good people are white people. So it's a bit weird that you get that kind of thing, that and you get this in the other books as well. Like, okay, where after the apocalypse, where does the drama come from? The book Nightfall by Asimov and Robert Silverberg. They did that as well. Again, the first third of the book is people doing predictions. The middle third is about the apocalypse falling, and then the next third, or the last third, is like, well, where does the story come from? Where does the conflict come from once the apocalypse has hit and we're now living in a post-apocalyptic world? And again, in a lot of these things, it has to come from, well, there's humans, and, well, humans are bad. So when the apocalypse hits, when the end of the world hits, when Armageddon happens, it's just going to be humans versus humans. And we'll have the good humans over here represented by good people and have the bad humans over here represented. And you get that again a bit in the Day of the Triffids as well. However, in the Day of the Triffids, this is what I really enjoy about this book, is that after the apocalypse happens, after everyone gets wiped out, and in this case, of course, everyone goes blind and most people die because they're blind and nobody can look after them, suddenly there is this extra source of drama, this extra source of threat, this extra jeopardy that comes in the form of the Triffids, in the form of the plants that come, the living plants that walk around and try and kill people. And so the actual apocalypse itself is just the kind of trigger for the larger drama, which is going to play out with a much reduced cast of characters, not the entire population of England in that case, just a few different different things. And there is a bit of like interhuman drama, and like there's right at the very end, it mentions, oh, these people come over and we're going to take over here and take over here, and these other guys go, nope, catch you later, see you later, and then use the Triffids to get out of a situation into, and to escape and things like that. And what I really liked about The Stand is that, like Lucifer's Hammer, you have the apocalypse. Well, actually, put it this way. Unlike Lucifer's Hammer, it just starts off. It's like, boom, wipe everyone out. And that's the first quarter of the book. And then after that, you get the rebuilding kind of stuff, which happens in some of these other novels. Excuse me, I just got to take a drink. But then, at the same time, you have this extra threat that comes in, this extra level of drama, this extra level of jeopardy. Like in the Day of the Triffids, you actually get this non-human opponent, even though this non-human opponent is kind of manifest into Randall Flagg, who is a human, maybe, kind of, I'm sure. Actually, I'm not sure, but I'm sure that he's only kind of a human. You actually get this interesting situation where, instead of like in Lucifer's Hammer, it just turns into an action war movie where the good guys subjugate the women, but that's not as bad as the black people eating other people. And in Nightfall, it just turns into skirmishes, and in the Triffids it gets this like non-human continuing threat, and also you get the Earth Abides thing, which is this small community that tries to make it after everyone's wiped out by a plague. You get this non-human source of threat which comes in, and it's very blatant. It's like, okay, here we go, the wiping out of all the Earth is suddenly allowing the forces of supernatural good and evil to come to the forefront in society, come to the forefront again, and re-influence tech, like the humans who have up until that point been distracted by technology, distracted by society, being distracted by culture. Once all that kind of stuff is wiped out, suddenly the spiritual forces, which are around thousands and thousands of years ago, have now suddenly come back into the foreground. So again, the flu is kind of like a spark, and then this extra level of tension just comes back in again, and which I really enjoyed, and because I think that's quite refreshing for post-apocalyptic fiction. And it's how, of course, how Stephen King was bringing it along, and he makes a lot of comments and talks about that, like a bit of commentary about that as he goes through the novel, that it isn't just about about good and evil. It's about people who have that reconnection to spirituality and to, versus the people who obviously have a connection to the spirituality as well, but again, once again, trying to subjugate it by technology and evil deeds, or whatever, you know, and turning back to the old way of life. But again, once the conflict is resolved, and then there's kind of like the epilogue of what happens after the conflict is resolved, you really start thinking, okay, after this battle has played itself out, is anyone learning the lessons, or is it going to go in the way that other people want? And you realize that there might be this same battle is going to be played out again, maybe on a smaller scale within America, or on a larger scale across the world, or roughly on the same scale, but you know, some people are going to leave different communities and set up other communities, and we may have the same kind of conflict again and again and again. Really weird thing. But then again, I'm thinking, well, if it's just a kind of a retelling of the Lord of the Rings, maybe the people going off into different places are just like the elves leading the other people who are influential in the story are going, actually, I'm going to go over to the other island, other continent. Don't know what it is in Lord of the Rings, can't remember. Anyway, so the last thing that I want to talk about here is, again, coming back to the spiritual elements of this novel. What I really, really enjoyed is that quite early on in the book, once you realise, there is going to be some kind of supernatural, spiritual elements playing into this book, Stephen King, right? I'm not sure, I can't remember if it was a character who was saying this, or it was the narrator himself, Stephen King's self. But this was the only notes that I made throughout the entire time that I was listening, because often when I'm listening to an audiobook, I'll bring up my, you know, iPhone and type in some notes, or type it some quotes, or type up some questions and things like that, or make a mark of something that I want to talk about later. And this is the only things that I wrote up through the entire time I was listening to this 48-hour audiobook, because this really does wrap up the entirety of the book for me. And it comes, like I say, probably about a quarter of the way through. It says, "The religious mania is the only surefire way to explain everything. Once you believe in God or the devil, nothing is left to chance. We see through a glass darkly." That's another line. And then it says, "Mysterious are the ways he chooses to work. Logic can be thrown out the window." So when an author just says, look, I'm going to tell a story, and it's going to be about religious mania, and it's going to be about the devil versus God, nothing is left to chance. So anything that happens here, you may think, oh, that's a bit unbelievable. Well, it's not unbelievable, because it's not just chance, so it's not just improbable. Maybe it's improbably unbelievable, but probability is now thrown out the window. If I want two characters to meet and do this, they can. If I want this to happen, it can. If I want that to happen, it can. And while some of it might be spiritual, and other bits might just be the story, and other bits might be, you know, just natural probability and natural chance, religious mania is the way that you could explain this entire book. And also, mysterious are the ways he chooses to work, and logic can be thrown out the window. That comes in a very interesting way. Because what I really loved about this book is that it is like it's like someone has said, okay, what if for the last few thousand years, God has had much less influence on the world because of technology and society and, you know, rational thought and all of that kind of stuff. But, you know, he's there in the background. So once all of that technology and rational thought gets wiped out in a big plague or something like that, what if something else can come back? What would he do? And you're thinking, well, okay, he would do... Well, where would we turn to find out what God is like? Where would we turn to find the mind of God? And you think, well, you can turn to the Bible. But why the Bible? Why not the Quran? Why not these other things? You know, what makes the Old Testament less valid than the New Testament? Because this is kind of very much more of an Old Testament kind of God. But what if it's more of a, like a kind of the way that the Hindus look at it? And there's not just one God, there's many different gods. But okay, if we just concentrate on the Bible is written by, well, the Bible, it's weird that the Bible is written by the victors. And the victors aren't just, you know, history isn't just written by the victors. Also, theology is written by the victors. In any kind of theological debate, it's the people who then control the orthodoxy who cast the rest of the people in the debate as the non orthodox as the heresies. They become the heresies. Even at the time, the heresies, more people might believe in the heresy than they do in what becomes the orthodox. But the proto-orthodox position becomes orthodox, and the other one is written away as heresy and is no longer known in the world. So I'm just thinking, okay, so the Bible is written by the people who decided what God would be like or how God works. And the other ways, the other stories, the other prophecies, the other stories that happen there, they've all been written out. They've all been edited out. But the Bible wasn't written, or the Bible stories in the Bible weren't written by the people who went through those stories, but the people long after, and like I say, through the lens of their theology and their expectations. I'm not saying that the people in the Bible are historical, but this is the kind of thing that you would, if you're writing a book about a new kind of spirituality, this is the way that you've got to look at the Bible. So you read the book of Job, and Job is like, what the fuck's going on here? But we don't know, like, Job doesn't know what God is doing. Job's like, hey, wait, I'm a good guy. Why am I getting punished? Why am I getting punished? And he doesn't know that, you know, the devil and Jesus and going, hey, let's fuck this guy up and see if he still becomes, you know, see if he's still righteous, you know, see if he's still faithful in God, even if we totally fuck him up. And God's like, yeah, let's do it. And so that's what they do. You know, it was actually God who's fucking up Job's life. He kills all his family and wipes out everything that he owns. And then the whole book's him going, what the fuck's going on? And then you got something like Lamentations, which is all like, all is vanity. It's all meaningless. What's going on around here? What's going on? The people who are actually living through these stories, if you actually said, like, okay, guys, what's going on? They would go, fuck it, I don't know what's going on. Just prayer work. I'm praying, I'm praying, I'm praying. God's not listening to me. This is Job. I'm praying, God's not listening to me. Where is he? Fucking, he's gone. I don't know what's going on. Does prophecy work? Well, some cases prophecy does work, and some cases prophecy doesn't work. And sometimes you pray for someone and they're healed, and sometimes healing doesn't work, and sometimes this and sometimes that. Now, if that was actually happening to us, we'd be like, fuck, I don't understand. The good guys, we're the good guys, yeah? Why aren't we winning? Shouldn't we be winning? We're the good guys. But if you're at that point in the story in the Bible, and the good guys are getting their asses kicked, you're like, what's the fuck's going on? And this book and The Stand is a lot of people like wandering around from place to place, and you're thinking, well, they're just wandering around. But then if you read like Exodus and, you know, Leviticus and those books, Numbers and Deuteronomy, it's like the wilderness years, 40 years in the wilderness. They've got to kill off an entire generation of people who aren't allowed to enter the promised land, and only their sons and daughters and stuff can enter the promised land. And so you've got like 40 years of wandering in the desert. Now we just read this like, oh yeah, 40 years, Moses, blah blah blah, hit the rock with the stick, water comes out, look at the snake, yeah, you're all healed, 10 commandments, lots of laws, lots of sacrifices. But at the time, people are going, fuck, what's going on? And, you know, Moses goes up the mountain and the people are like, oh well, what's going on? Golden calf, anyone? Let's do it. Fuck, oh fuck, we did it wrong, everyone's killed, oh fuck, like, you know, and just everything's going wrong for these people, and there is no set theology. There is no way to understand what God is doing. And I think that's really interesting that The Stand is a book told from the point of view of people who are partway through this kind of religious journey, this kind of theologically inspired, well, not inspired, but like God has commanded people to do this thing, and they don't know the end game. They don't know what's going to happen all the way through to the end. And then after another few generations, this is going to be all written down as this big conflict between good and evil. And it's going to come out like a conflict between good and evil in the same way that we read it in the Bible, where everything's explained and God did this because of this and God did that because of this. But the people at the time didn't know why God was doing it. And, you know, you really were seeing God through the glass darkly. I was going to say through the scanner darkly, but through the glass darkly. And, you know, logic is kind of thrown out the window. So, yeah, that's why I really enjoyed this book from that kind of new, like, proto-orthodoxy kind of point of view. And you can try and, like, even when you're reading this book, you can try and work out what God is doing. It's like, okay, so why do these people have to go over there? And they didn't seem to achieve very much. But, like, a lot of the people in the Bible go and try and do something and they don't achieve very much. You know, like Jonah, you go, hey, go over there. And he goes over there, and the journey on the way, he gets swallowed by the big fish, and then he gets spat out. And then at the end, he says, hey, guys, repent. And they all repent. And God doesn't give his judgment. And Jonah's like, what the fuck, God? I came all this way and you were going to damn all these people and you're going to wipe them all out. And God's like, yeah, but they listened to you. And he's like, well, that's not very satisfying. I want everyone to be killed. You said everyone's going to be killed and now you saved everyone. It's like, well, you saved, you know, and there's that whole kind of thing going on. You're just like, what the fuck? Like Jonah, even at the time, he's going, God, what's going on? So yeah, that's what we have in the stand, but in a very satisfying way. And of course, I was going to talk about the ending. There is, I think, a very good, interesting ending at the end here, where the culmination of this battle between good and evil comes together. And again, you can read in your own theology into this. You can read, okay, so when there's this Deus Ex Machina that happens at the end, the whole book is about trying to get God to do a Deus Ex Machina, or the devil to do a Deus Ex Machina, and then it happens. There is a machine of the gods, or whatever it is, and some bigger spiritual force does come in near the end of the book, and you're just thinking, well, okay, what does that mean? And it's kind of left up to us as the reader to kind of piece together, and a few of the characters afterwards are going, well, why did we do that? Oh, what was going on? What was all the point of that? And they're like, well, it worked, didn't it? And they're like, yeah, but why did it work? And you can really see where all of this new spirituality and this new theology is going to come from in this new society that's being set up there. So it really isn't hard science fiction. And if you're trying to, if you just want to read a fantasy book, which is in like I mentioned before, in the previous episode of The Way of Kings, it's like, okay, everything is already set out. They know all the rules. They know how magic works. They know what the world is like. You've got people who are there. You've got people who are doing stuff, and everything is set up there. Even if this character doesn't know the answers, there are people who know the answers. And more importantly, Thingy, who wrote it, Brandon Sanderson, he knows all the rules. It's all set out in his head. He's got everything set out. And The Stand is like the opposite of that. Even though they're comparable books in length, the tone of the book is totally different, especially in terms of the fantasy / mysticism kind of angle. So that's all I've got to do. That's all I'm going to say today on this episode. I really hope you've enjoyed it. Send me emails. Luke@juggler.net if you want any information, or if you want to give me book recommendations. I reply to every single email, although I am a bit behind in some of the emails that I reply to. Otherwise, you can discuss with other people about this review that I've given, about other reviews. Go to goodreads.com and check out the SFBRP listeners group there, or become my friend on Goodreads and follow my reviews and the other books that I'm reading. I always update it. The next book that I'll be reviewing, I've actually got a few books that I need to review. I read Dune as an audiobook, or listened to Dune as an audiobook, again from Audible, and enjoyed that, and I didn't do a review of that, but I might do a review of the audio version of Dune, even though I've already reviewed Dune as a paperback when I read it a few years ago. And also, I did finish the Book of the New Sun series, the Citadel of the Autarch, which is the final book in that series. What I'm going to do probably, though, is instead of reviewing that, I'm going to probably read The Earth of the New Sun, which is like a book which follows that, another novel that follows that, read that one, and then review the entire Book of the New Sun, or the New Sun saga, which is 5 books in a row, and I'll do a special episode where I review every single, like all of the books as a single story. I'll probably do that. Also, watch out for in the future, I'm going to be doing some SFF audio podcast as well. We're going to be interviewing, me and Jesse are going to be doing a discussion with Jonathan Davis, who is one of our favourite, both of our favourite audiobook narrator. I've read and reviewed lots of his books as well. And yeah, I think that's about it. So yeah, finally, check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP if you want to check out a free 30-day membership, get yourself a free audiobook on me, and help support the show, and check out an audiobook from audible.com. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.